All right, let's head over to the Zoom line where we've got the Carbon King of Austin on the line with us. Not the Sausage King of Chicago, but the Carbon King of Austin. He's known as Jason Isaac. How you doing today, sir?
I'm doing great. You know, I love it when Congressman Raskin from Maryland referred to me as the Carbon King when I was testifying in front of one of his committees. It was the only note that I wrote down. You know, I tell people I live a high carbon lifestyle and the rest of the world should too. It's truly where you have economic prosperity and environmental leadership. And so I embrace the moniker of the Carbon King.
Steve Bakken also joining us. My name is Jason Spies. I'm in my sports attire today for anybody out there who's watching us on the video. Jason Isaac is in Austin, Texas. Steve Bakken is in his vehicle, just got out of a doctor's appointment. How you doing, Steve?
Good. How you doing, my friend?
Hey, not too bad. All right, let's get right to the interview here, the Chevron Doctrine. One of the things that happens in the media from time to time is they will release news Friday afternoon. Well, this news coincided with a court case that came out around the same time, and things that happen on a Friday afternoon do not get reported much. And so we want to talk about the Chevron Doctrine today, the Supreme Court case. Jason Isaac wrote a piece on it, talked about it recently. And what was your takeaway, Jason, from the Chevron Doctrine, which essentially kind of gives states more control and kind of takes away some of the regulatory body powers, if my interpretation is correct? Am I reading it right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. This is a case from 1984, so 40 years ago, the Chevron, the oil and gas company versus the NRDC, the national, this is the climate cult, if you will, in D.C. Essentially, every single employee in the Biden administration is vetted through the NRDC. And there was this case 40 years ago that basically gave the bureaucratic deep state the authority to interpret laws how they wanted to apply rules, and really kind of gave the fourth branch of government the ability to make law. And that's not what the Constitution prescribed. Those powers should be, by the power of Congress. And the Supreme Court on Friday correctly overturned the Chevron doctrine or Chevron deference, and now says that Congress, in writing laws, must be very specific in their lawmaking. And the deep state is very worried that this could slow down some of their things. I've heard stories about requiring that fishermen pay for a government employee to be on their boat to monitor their work. And this was really brought as about of a case of some fishermen that my work at the Texas Public Policy Foundation has worked on, where we're suing the Department of Interior, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, because they're just green lighting projects, ignoring environmental assessments, which is part of the law. But these bureaucrats are doing what they want. You think about some of the EV mandates, the new clean power plan that is only going to separate us from our food, fuel, and our money, with higher costs for everything, including electricity and energy. Those programs and those rules are under serious threat right now. And so I think the big winner on Friday with this Supreme Court ruling was the American people and the Republic, if we can keep it.
Just to
Jason,
go ahead. Going to bring up, we're talking about like the EPA and a lot of these different alphabet agencies.
The correct? Alphabet agencies, yeah.
Go ahead, Steve. Go ahead.
So, Jason, going back, and this case goes back to 1984, and at what step along the way did what a lot of people take a look as the green agenda now? You got to go back to this 84 case and the impetus of where this agenda started, and it's come in different, global warming, global cooling, now we'll just call it climate change. Some of us kind of still call it weather. But where did the agenda begin? Where did that side of the aisle start thinking that, maybe there's a different path that we can be benefiting from the boom of oil and traditional energy sources? Because Jason and I don't call them fossil fuels. They're traditional energy sources, oil, coal, gas. Where did that narrative start shifting to? It's about control and power, because I kind of pin it a little bit on 84, but it goes back a little earlier than that, doesn't it?
It really does. It goes back, you know, just generations of prosperity that we've experienced because of our access to affordable, reliable energy. And people don't like that prosperity. There are some very Malthusian people out there that are concerned with the Industrial Revolution that was powered by energy. I heard Chris Wright recently speak. You know, he's the CEO of Liberty Energy. And he says, and I'm paraphrasing, energy isn't a part of the economy. It is everything that the economy is based on. And without it, we have no economy. And because of our economic prosperity, we have environmental leadership. We're producing more energy. We're growing. But I think there are some people that really don't like that. You get Jane Goodall in front of the World Economic Forum that says, "And we, you know, for our planet to be sustainable, we need to get back to a population that we had in the 1500s. That's a 95% reduction from today. That's absolutely.
Wait a minute. I've heard this out of a friend of our governor here in North Dakota, Bill Gates, about controlling the population. You know, people kind of lump this into being a conspiracy theory thing, but that globalist agenda is real. It exists.
It really is. You're absolutely right, Steve. And it's funny because, you know, I heard Scott Rasmussen talk lately that he was saying something along the lines of, you know, elites believe, over 70% of elites believe that everybody should have an electric vehicle, that we need to ban gasoline-powered cars, and that over 76% believe that we need to ban fossil fuels. And the problem that Steve pointed out, Scott Rasmussen pointed out was that overwhelmingly elites believe that everyone else agrees with them. And this was so evident at an event I attended last week where a former BlackRock executive said, you know, I really support the UN's principles for responsible investing, and I believe everybody else does too. I mean, and that's like perfect words coming out of a self-righteous globalist elite that believes that he knows what's best for everyone else, and he is directing capital in that direction, even though I've never voted for anybody at BlackRock to do anything. They are not part of my representative republic, you know, the government that I support. So it's unbelievable, but it is. It's very Malthusian people. I think Bill Gates is Malthusian. I think he thinks there's too many of us on this planet. You know, he funds a program within the UN that provides a long-term implantable birth control for women in Africa because they know they're going to be attacked on their journeys to collect water because they don't have access to power. And to me, he's just got it completely backwards on that. They should be funding billions of dollars for economic development in Africa to use dense fuels like propane, natural gas, coal, things that would help get them out of poverty and experience the prosperity that we take for granted and the clean air and the clean water that we take for granted. So I know I digressed on that question, Steve, but
you're spot on though, because in a lot of people call them the one percenters. I call them the 10th percenters because it is that narrow of a bandwidth of that globalist agenda that it's about power and control, and not having food security, not having energy security, puts people in a really bad position, and you're under control of somebody else.
So go ahead. Jason, I'm cutting you off. I will say, yeah, my years of research and serving in an office, I have come to the conclusion that the climate cult Kool-Aid is this cult-like fascination with decarbonization. Everything's comes back to getting rid of the CO2 in the atmosphere. I mean, Apple ran a commercial with Lisa Jackson that says, our aim is to remove CO2 from the atmosphere. That would end all life on Earth. We're talking about a trace gas that's 0.04% of our atmosphere. And more science is coming out now that's showing that as the Earth warms, CO2 emissions increase. And it's not the other way around, that CO2 is not driving the warming. It's the warming that's driving the increase in CO2. And that warming is being driven by the sun. And so, Yeah, you know, I heard RFK say he was doing some debate at the same time, and it's like, why am I listening to him? But he finally called carbon capture what it really is. He says it's a boondoggle, and I'm like, okay, there's. I always look for things I can agree with people on, so we can find some commonality, and that just happens to be the one, you know. And I don't support vaccine mandates either. Does you know RFK? So maybe there's two things that I agree with him on, but boy, well, everything else about him is just climate catastrophism.
That's where they want to put the big sunscreen up over the entire planet, because what could go wrong, right?
Well, let's kind of circle back here to the Chevron doctrine, because I think that's a really important part of this. Because when we take a look at the deep state, there are deep states within a state, and there's groups called RINOs, Republicans in name only, which are within a traditional Republican Party. And the RINOs tend to really create a deeper state. And so when I think of the shift of now going to local, Jason, talk to me a little bit about some of the inner politics happening within the state levels and how this can be abused on the state level, because what we're starting to see now are Republicans or business owners who fought adamantly against carbon quickly doing a 180, trying to grab the carbon subsidies and saying, oh, we'll do it for the greater good. And to me, I noticed a lot of them are in the RINO camp, and I'm not trying to be political. I just noticed that they are kind of in that, you know, that climate czar vein, if you will. And so what's your thoughts on how locally there's going to be some transparency and checks and balances that need to happen because of all the government surge dollars now who've already been allocated to climate capture, the greater good, if you will? It's because in our mind, in North Dakota, for example, it's literally like a mad dash. It's like that mad world. People pushing each other out of the way, trying to get the 45Q subsidy. What was the one we heard the other day, Steve? The 90 QRS or something. We heard a new subsidy that came out of
nowhere. LMNOP something or other. Yeah.
We have alphabet agencies, but we got alphabet tax credits too. So talk to me a little bit about the checks and balances states need to have now to keep an eye on their deep states internally they have. I know you're out of Texas, but you're out of Austin, Texas, so I think you know a little bit what I'm talking about, Jason.
No, absolutely. And there's only been four states who's refused money from the Inflation Reduction Act, and it's Iowa, North Dakota, South Dakota, Tennessee, and Florida. And so you've only got a few states that have actually just said, you know what, we're not going to take the money. But now, you know, that you have to remember the people that can afford to get access to elected officials are the elite. These are corporate lobbyists that have been hired. This is their full-time job. They're being, you know, played by corporations. People that are out in the, you know, like my son who's out in the oil field today working in the Permian Basin doesn't have access to elected officials because that's not his full-time job. And so these elected officials are hearing one side, and they're being told that, hey, look at all the money that we could capture, all the federal dollars that we could bring back to our state, because the 45Q tax credit used to be $50 per ton. Well, no one was doing it then because it didn't make economic sense. It doesn't make sense. It didn't make economic sense. Well, so with the Inflation Reduction Act, they increased it to $180 a ton, and it's no longer a credit. It's a direct cash payment. So now you're getting tax dollars from Americans and, you know, generations in the future that'll be paying off the debt on that to build these programs. And so governors, elected officials, they're seeing these dollar signs like, oh, so-and-so corporation wants to build a massive pipeline and we can store CO2 here and we'll get all these credits and we'll have all this money and all this economic development. It is a total boondoggle is exactly what it is. And so, you know, and this is one of the things that the Chevron doctrine case could impact, because It was a 2007 case based almost entirely on the 2004 case that said that they changed the classification of CO2 as a pollutant. And so that could fall. And I think this whole thing crumbles, this whole climate agenda crumbles on that. But, you know, don't get me started. You know, there's people are actually making the connection now that humidity is causing heat and traps heat. So, you know, I'm sure there's going to be some direct air capture of water vapor before long. And they'll ask for a huge incentive to pull, you know, humidity out of the air to keep us from getting so hot during the summer.
I'm going to make a comment and then hand it over to Steve. Steve Hawken is the former mayor of Bismarck and current Burley County commissioner. So I want to get his perspective as well. So I've said this for about, I don't know, 10 years, 8 years, that I saw the carbon industry becoming the umbrella over ag and energy, to where it was going to be kind of the trinity was going to be carbon, ag, and energy together. And it was going to be kind of run and regulated by technology, if you will, and innovation, because technology and innovation really runs government. It kind of directs government in a lot of ways. So the other part that directs government is the reaction of public health. So I started seeing this carbon through the oil and gas industry, the way that they were approaching the oil and gas industry, the same way they are approaching the cigarette industry. So if you want to go watch the movie The Insider with Russell Crowe or some of these other terrific movies that have been done documenting the tobacco industry, the rise and the fall, it very much goes along that line of public health. Now, in North Dakota, there was a smoking ban. And what they did is they made all the bar owners upgrade their venting situations and all these other things. So they had to go and get loans and upgrade their innovation and their technology in order to stay in business. Well, then a year or two later, they banned smoking. And those bar owners were still in debt and on the hook for all these different things because they had to invest into their businesses. I see the same thing happening here, to where I believe, and I've said this for probably 8 years on record, they're going to end up using eminent domain through public health in the same way they use cigarette smoke with secondhand smoke, basically through eminent domain of our airspace to pass laws. Jason and Steve, I'm going to hand it off to you because you kind of know what I'm talking about here. But Steve, you went through the smoking ban with the mayor and you kind of are involved with the different areas. Do you see a shift happening where this carbon could be classified under public health in order to advance a lot of these different pipelines or direct air carbon capture things or whatever the case is? Because eminent domain is being used on land, but it's also being used as a way to get science and innovation done too. So I'm going to hand it off to you, Steve, and let you ask the question out of it, that context.
Well, absolutely. And you're looking at a lot of things being on. You can hide a lot of agenda under the guise of public health. And, you know, it's kind of like, hey, who's not in favor of babies and puppies, right? You know, who's not in favor of clean air? Who's not in favor of having clean water? You know, Jason, when you're looking at this green agenda and the you know, I tell Jason all the time that it's, you know, things are usually pretty good until they get bastardized by a political agenda. And then the narrative gets created out of, okay, well, where do we want the narrative to go to promote our agenda? When you're looking at the guise of public health and public safety, and, you know, as an elected official myself, you got to be guarded against, okay, what are you trying to accomplish and how are you trying to get there? Because like in diction, words matter. Language and nuance matters. For the ability to sweep things under the rug and hide things under, you know, a political agenda under the guise of public health or the greater good, that's really a real thing, isn't it, Jason?
No, it absolutely is. And you're talking about political agendas, and they do. I mean, I've got PowerPoints from the left of how to message this, what to say, what not to say, how to drive home our political agenda. And they're using marketing techniques that have been very successful over the last few decades. And you really look at the last decade, and it's great because I've had my hand at pulling one apart, this ESG initiative, this environmental, social, and governance initiative that's forcing companies to bend the knee to political agendas. And it's been great marketing. It's very feel good. It's very emotional messaging. You know, in Texas, we pushed back and we said, if you're going to really embrace ESG and force your political agendas on companies, then you're no longer welcome to do business with the state of Texas. As a bill I wrote in 2020, it became law in 2021. And it basically now has BlackRock on the boycott list. And so what's BlackRock doing is BlackRock is investing millions of dollars in other associations to try to write reports saying it's a bad idea. These laws are bad. They've been very successful in Louisiana, for example, of killing this model policy now. In Louisiana earlier this year, based on faulty reporting, some reporting that I just published at the American Energy Institute. You can see it on our website, AmericanEnergyInstitute.com. There's some data that's there that shows that they're using erroneous numbers in their reporting to try to drive an agenda, but they're being quite successful at it. But I think Americans, I think people around the world are waking up. You see European elections moving to the right because they're sick and tired of the climate alarmist agenda, this political agenda that is really only resulting in one thing, and that's more expensive food, fuel, and everything. And energy costs are skyrocketing. It's leading to deindustrialization throughout Germany and throughout the United Kingdom. Companies are just moving to China. And we're seeing it here in the United States recently with the announcement from John Deere. I mean, they're moving operations to Mexico. Cheaper labor, cheaper power, less environmental regulation. And those regulations are all driven, you know, or not all, but mostly from the deep state bureaucrats within the EPA, the Department of Energy, Department of Interior, that are forcing companies to agree to this agenda. But I am worried because of this whole decarbonization effort and the amount of money that's been spent on it, that some of these companies are now going to go to state leaders and say, well, we can't abandon this because we've invested billions of dollars. Companies like Oxy, companies like BlackRock, who are just stupidly building direct air capture for carbon in the Permian Basin. That's like putting a wastewater treatment facility out in the middle of the ocean. You're not going to do anything. It's just a complete waste of hundreds of millions of dollars. And BlackRock is using teachers' pension money, firefighters, police officers using their pension money to throw into this. And so I am worried that some states aren't going to back down just because of the amount of money that's already been spent. But we're seeing, you know, Solyndra case after Solyndra case where the government is forcing things, dumping money into it. And it's going to be the investors who are ultimately, in this case, you know, pensioners and shareholders. They're going to be the ones that are losing out.
So, Jason, is there a tipping point? Because, you know, we hear about this from an economic perspective. Businesses and industries that are too big to fail, whether it's the aviation, whether it's an oil company, whether it's the automakers, too big to fail, you know, and the government will come along and bail them out because, well, we can't afford to have them fail. Is there a tipping point that we're approaching, or have we approached it or hit it already, where the green climate agenda and all the investment that's going into that agenda, because it's a political agenda, that the investment has gotten to the point where these companies have gotten to that too big to fail, or the agenda itself is too big to fail, and the companies that are bought into this, they know that, well, if the agenda goes away, then they're going to get the abyss along with it. Is there a tipping point there?
Yeah, there certainly is. And I think we're starting to see it with some companies that have reached the tipping point, like Toyota and Volkswagen. These are two companies that are pulling money out of their EV units and investing them into internal combustion engines, because that's what people are demanding. They want to make those engines more efficient, which I think is something the market would have done had the government not mandated electric.
Well, the market was already down that road, and the government pulled the rug out and actually, you know, and I give kudos to Toyota because they stayed the course. GM was very far down the road of hybrid vehicles, which is from an efficiency, and it's a better solution and a better road to go down. Toyota stayed the course on that. But GM and some of the other automakers, they were incentivized to know, leave that alone and go shift to a different direction. And that's where the politics really come into play, and not to the benefit of, well, the American public or any other public for that matter as well.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, Ford's now losing over $100,000 per electric vehicle sold. And the only reason they're going down this path is because of this illegal multiplier that EVs get credit for the corporate average fuel economy. And I've written about this at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. I launched research last year called Overcharged Expectations about Electric Vehicles that really breaks down all of the subsidies and benefits that EVs get. And you've got this incredible multiplier. So if you're a Tesla and you get credit for 50 miles per gallon, multiply that times 6.67. And that's how many credits you get. It's just some crazy arbitrary number that's supposed to be this liquid fuel incentive in the Federal Registry, but they've applied it to EVs. The Department of Energy has applied it to EVs. This is absolutely, there shouldn't be any market distorting policies there regardless. We need to get rid of the corporate average fuel economy. Let the market decide. We're already world leaders in clean air in this country. But there's a reason that they've had to do this. And you look in 2021, Tesla likely not profitable had it not been for the sales of their excess credits to other automobile manufacturers. So it's just complete market distortion that's propping up one company while it's crushing others. Shareholders are the ones that are losing out big time.
So one of the things that we've kind of uncovered covering the carbon industry over the last several years, and really we kind of backdoored into it through the ESG movement to where we looked at each one differently, but the advent of ESG, you can see the framework being done. And Jason, obviously, you down in Texas, you saw the environmental social governance framework being done and created legislation to combat that. So when I think of what's happening right now, it is a little bit alarming because it's almost as if the environmental social governance is and I've said this before, and I don't want to get too complex, but there needs to be a value system for a society. And for a long time in America, it was a Christian-based society. Yeah, there's a percentage of Hindu, there's a percentage of Muslim. And quite honestly, a lot of the value system, they pull from the same place. And so there was this collective kind of Christian or religious value system of the Ten Commandments. We'll just say the Ten Commandments at least was somewhat American. We'll just agree with that. When you start going away from that, and we've got examples up in North Dakota when Governor Burgum announced he was running for president, he did not mention the word God one time, but said environment 12 times. So for a Republican to do that for me was unbelievable, because I grew up in a day and age where if you didn't wear a flag lapel, you got kicked out of a party. That if you were Howard Dean and you got some momentum and you made a funny noise on stage, yee-haw, the Clintons kicked you right out. And yep. So for me, you know, a kind of a Republican announcing he's running for president and didn't mention the word God one time, as a reporter for 20, 30 years, I'm like, oh, that's new. Well, I layer that in with how the environment is really taking over kind of this. You can go outside and connect with the environment. So we need to preserve it because we've destroyed the Garden of Eden. So we must atone for our original sin. And I know it's crazy to say this for a lot of people out there, but the ESG movement is where a lot of the financing is starting to draw their value system from. And that's starting to be whether they're going to give you the money or not. No more about the free market. So what we've really uncovered in the last several years, Steve and myself having these carbon people on, the government has printed more money in the last 3 years than America did since its inception. So the government is now in control of an economy that is bigger than what America had for 200 and some years. And now it's being directed by ESG and a carbon movement. And that's worthy of a public discussion. And no one's having that public discussion. And it's all being driven by the, you name me one thing that's not carbon. There's nothing. It's, so is this
we're
a
carbon-based life forms.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a backdoor into tyranny. Yeah, it's a backdoor into fascism. Yeah, it's a backdoor into all this other crap. I don't care. There needs to be a public discussion in some form or another, Jason. I mean, help me out, man. Calm down.
It's like the original Star Trek movie when V'ger comes back and wants to get rid of the infestation of carbon-based life forms on the planet. That's the whole Bill Gates World Economic Forum globalist agenda to me. It comes right out of science fiction, but you cannot make that up.
No, but he brought up Oxy, and that's a great example, because Oxy was an oil and gas company for a long time, and the oil and gas industry did work hand in hand with the federal government for a long time. And getting back to the Chevron doctrine, there we go. So now, is this what's going to happen on a local level? Is that, you know, the carbon industry is going to direct? Is this a top, you know, bottom to top or top to bottom, Jason? How are we looking at this, I guess?
Yeah, I think it's probably a top to bottom where you've got big oil. And I just wrote a piece. It's up on my Substack, jasonisaac.com. You can find that there. There's a piece that I had published in the Dallas Express talking about big oil partnering with big green and the Biden administration to increase regulations for offshore drilling, which it's just, so you've got to expose them. You've got to expose them for this collusion where they're trying to crush the small producers. And so you've got this, I think it's about a $58 million problem over the last 78 years of abandoned wells that taxpayers have had to come in and foot the bill for cleaning them. That's or capping them. It's a really small problem, $58 million over 75 years. And now the solution is a $6.8 billion problem for assurance guarantees, this bonding requirement that won't apply to the majors. It's only going to apply to the smaller producers that don't have the same credit rating. And so that affects about 75% of the people that are operating in offshore oil production. They're now going to have to bear the cost. Those costs are going to get pushed along to the consumers, or the majors are going to come in and buy them because these companies can't afford to spend that kind of money. But this is part of the collusion that we're seeing where they're just out looking for themselves. It's one of the reasons I created the American Energy Institute. We're building a trade organization of American energy producers that support free markets first and foremost. We're primarily going to represent people in the oil and gas and coal and nuclear space. I've got members from those now, but we're building this new trade organization to push back, because I did research for over a year and found that almost every single national trade organization is embracing ESG or DEI, or as one of our board members likes to reference Winston Churchill, they're feeding the crocodiles, hoping they'll be the last ones eaten. They're trying to appease people. And as I like to tell people at the American Energy Institute, we don't feed the crocodiles, we wear them. And I think that's important for people to understand that we're not going to capitulate on these things like carbon capture and decarbonization and net zero and ESG and DEI, because they don't do anything to improve mankind. Give people access to energy to promote human flourishing. And so we're pushing back. And I think there's this movement. I mean, you look at what happened with Tractor Supply. Last month, Tractor Supply was exposed for all of their DEI initiatives. Yes, hiring people based on the color of their skin, giving them preferential treatment, that's illegal, but it was something that they were proud of. They were proud of their zero carbon goals and tracking carbon emissions. I mean, all of these woke policies, a month ago, it got exposed. We found videos of their CEO, a guy named Robbie Starbuck, a former producer from LA, exposed all this, found all this out. And they course corrected in less than a month. Imagine if Bud Light had done that a couple of years ago, had come out and said, we screwed up, we're not going to get involved in political agendas anymore. Their company would have been fine. Bud Light sales they would have recovered immediately. But they never did that. Well, Tractor Supply says, we're not going to be the Bud Light of, you know, farming and ranch equipment. we're going to correct. And they did. And they said, we are no longer going to participate or sponsor pride festivals. We're no longer going to track carbon. We're not going to report anything to the Human Rights Campaign, where all, if not most of this evil is based within the Human Rights Campaign.
I think Target just recently did some of that as well. They recorrected their social causes to reflect their finances. Yes, because it's just, hey, to me, it's a risk. You know, it's a risk to do that stuff. There's no market proven. It's a very, you know, if we're talking about the DEI and some of the pride movement things along, yes, there is an audience there and there is a percentage. And so if you were to vet through the proper marketing, because remember, marketing is more science. Public relations is different than marketing. People forget that stuff. And so if you vet through the proper marketing, you should be able to do the proper investments and react accordingly. But so many people are into feelings over reality. I call it the planet of platitudes versus the realm of reality. And I do believe this carbon industry is very much feelings over facts. In fact, I just, for some reason, this book happened to be on my desk. You mentioned earlier about how the sun, I've been saying it for 15, 20 years on my night show and a variety of other places, that the sun is our biggest driver on the planet. Probably land use is second. You know, how we choose to use our land is probably number two for the carbon indicator on the planet and temperature, but the sun is number one. And to think that we're bigger than the sun, my goodness, that's you want to talk about the sun being a god, that's a bigger god complex on the planet than the sun is the god. So I do appreciate you mentioning the sun earlier, because I do think that is the truth. I think that the sun indicates our temperature and our planet more than anything. What kind of reaction do you get from these 6-7 figured leaders if you try to bring up the sun? If you try, I don't know if you bring up land use or not, but you seem like an educated man if you bring up the sun. And land use is usually number two for most people. When you start talking about roads and agriculture use and all these different things, that is going to do a lot more for our planet than any sort of recycling plastic bags.
Yeah, you know, straws. I miss my straws.
Oh man, me too. That's crazy. The whole straws. I mean, give me a break. I'm going to go burn a tire when we finish this, just to have a little bit. No, you know, it's interesting because I get to talk to a lot of politicians around the country, and I get to share with them some of the science. And I, you know, I try to be persuasive in my messaging as much as possible. A lot of people don't know that we've reduced pollution nearly 80% over the last 5 decades in this country. We're world leaders in clean air. We're number one in access to clean and safe drinking water. People don't understand that. They don't know that today women are going to spend 200 million hours walking to collect water because they don't have access to energy. And imagine if we could get them propane and LNG and coal and help those countries develop. We could completely eliminate poverty. We stand over the key. I know you do in North Dakota and we do in Texas. We stand over the key to producing that energy that would alleviate and lift the last 10% of the global population out of poverty. But we've become focused on something that's 0.04%. So I've had the opportunity to testify in front of Congress 4 times now. I always take a carbonated beverage with me, you know, to testify, because I'll take a sip of it. And I said, I just ingested higher concentrations of CO2 than what's in the atmosphere, and I'm not going to spontaneously combust. I assure you that. Now, the people on the left would combust. And I talk about, there are no wealthy, low energy countries on the planet. The only low energy countries on the planet are poor countries. You look at high CO2 emissions per capita, the ones that have the highest, it's the cleanest environments, it's the cleanest water. It's one of the reasons I embrace and promote people to live the high carbon lifestyle. It does nothing. Getting rid of CO2 in the atmosphere, and I'll use the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's model. They have this, it's called the MAGIC, the model for the assessed greenhouse gas induced climate change, long acronym for MAGIC. but it's this model that shows that what happens if you do decarbonation. And the Heritage Foundation just put this calculator out on their website. It's great. So now you can, you don't have to recreate the model, which is very time consuming, but you can use Heritage's, and I've checked it to make sure it's accurate. If we completely decarbonize the United States by 2050, maybe you saw the video of Senator Kennedy from Louisiana asking the guy from the Department of Energy, what happens if we do this? What happens? And the guy says, you know, we're an important part of, you know, the mission. We're 13% of global CO2 greenhouse gas emissions. We've got to reduce those and we've got to eliminate them. But he wouldn't answer the question, what happens if we hit net zero by 2050? He refused to answer it. And it's one of these times where some people scream at the TV because they're watching sports, and I'm screaming at the TV watching politicians because I know the answer to the question. By 2100, if you do that, by 2050, if you achieve net zero in the U.S., the temperature differential, according to the UN, the model that they're using, is less than 1/10 of 1 degree by 2100. If you do it globally, their models, it's 0.2 of a degree. But in the U.S., we spend $50 trillion to achieve for nothing. And that shows the complete absurdity behind decarbonization.
Now, and Jason, I want to come back to the science on here for a minute, because, you know, with the Chevron doctrine, of course, the alphabet agencies, EPA, in our case in North Dakota, has made a big deal trying to put the clamps, because, you know, we've got the Theodore Roosevelt National Park, which gives them a little primacy to get their foot in the door to try to regulate. They've put some pushes on, well, you know, with our coal-fired power plants and some of the flaring and, you know, the air quality. Well, it's kind of interesting. They usually do the air quality test when Canada's having massive wildfires and we've got smoke in the air, and they're trying to blame that, even though they take the wind or the air quality measurements upwind of our coal-fired power plants. Because it's Canadian wildfires. That brings us back to the science, because just like statistics, I can make numbers say anything I want. A lot of the politicization of science is it's the narrative. So you've got junk science on one side versus junk science on the other side, which I think there's a real movement to try to blur the lines and cause confusion to the public. So when the public hears science and numbers, I don't think they can believe what they're being told. Talk a little bit about the science, because there is legitimate science out there, but I think it's incumbent upon people to try to navigate what that science is.
Yeah, you're right, Steve. I mean, I'm looking at headlines today talking about toxic air in places like Louisiana and other states, and I'm like, no, there's not. So you've got the leftist media and the climate alarmist agenda, this cartel, they're colluding and they are working together to drive the same narrative. And I hope, and I think the American people are starting to wake up to the fact that they're being manipulated, they're being misled with things like dirty air. Yeah, there's one good thing that I can think of that came out of the COVID lockdowns. And believe me, not much, if anything, was good during that time frame. But it gave us an opportunity to look at the differences in air quality from a robust economy to an economy that came to a screeching halt. And I heard this electric vehicle lobbyist in Texas say later that year, November, I think it was early November, saying that because we took half the cars off the road in Austin, that our air quality improved so much that we need to mandate electric vehicles. And I couldn't believe he said that. I was like, man, people lost their lives. They lost their jobs. Businesses closed. That's a terrible way to make a connection that's a good thing that our air got cleaner and we need to go 100% electric vehicles. So I asked my colleagues, you know, at the Texas Public Policy Foundation, said, you know, I served on the Environmental Regulation Committee in the Texas House. I was very involved with our Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, the second largest environmental government agency outside of the EPA in the world. Then I said, we've got air quality monitors. I want to do some research and publish research on how much the air quality improved during the first 2 months of the lockdowns with 50% of the cars off the road. And quite honestly, I was expecting that you might see a somewhat, you know, significant measurable improvement in air quality. And the fact of the matter is the air quality in Austin got worse. And so we expanded the research and started looking at cities around the country. In almost every major city, the air quality got worse during the first 2 months of the COVID lockdown. You saw some that had some negligible improvements, and they were all negligible. They're all on the margins. But what it showed me and leads me to believe that we're world leaders in clean air, that we've already achieved a natural state for air quality in this country, that things like wildfires in Canada and California, and now in the southern United States, the Saharan dust, and wildfires in Mexico, those impact our air quality, especially Asian air pollution. You know, I've joked, of all the technology the Chinese steal from us, it'd be nice if they would utilize our pollution control technology. They don't. They could care less about it. And it actually impacts our air quality. But we've done as much as we can possibly do. So there is no justification for mandating electric vehicles. There's no justification for increasing any regulations, because our air is beyond anything that improves human health. We've actually gone too far. It's almost too stringent. And so now that research is starting to come out, that we're actually getting warmer because more sunlight is making its way to the surface because man has reduced pollution. There's research that's coming out on shipping lanes at the parts of the top couple of millimeters of the ocean in high traffic shipping lanes are getting warmer because of the sulfur dioxide that we've removed from the fuels. So it's like we've almost done too good of a job. And now Bill Gates wants to put reflectors into the atmosphere to bounce the sun back to the earth.
What happened to our old friend Acid Rain? I was kind of looking forward to that one.
So, Jason, what should someone do? Because, you know, one of the things as we kind of wrap up here, I like to try to give a call to action or a solution. It doesn't have to be the right solution. It doesn't even have, you know, just something for someone to at least move to the next step. And I'll be honest, the last 6 months, I've been having a very hard time trying to understand what the next step is, because up into my area, Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, honestly, the same leaders have been there my whole life. I mean, really, when you take a look at that inner circle, they've been here my whole life. And if you look at nationally, President Biden actually helped bring coal into our daily lives only to usher it out. I mean, when you take a look at what leadership has been there for a long time, we mentioned the pride word earlier. That is an example that I have been giving out for 6 months, not from a political standpoint, from a science standpoint, because I truly believe the hidden agenda behind the whole trans movement is to tear down our boundaries so we don't even know what a man and woman is anymore. We have to rely on the government to tell a man and woman. And I mean totally serious. People think I'm being political. No. When you can't even go out in society and agree on what a man or a woman is, how the heck are we supposed to agree on what carbon is, or what a GMO crop is, or what a sidewalk is, or what a chair is, or what a Michael Crichton book is? I mean, Jason, when I take a look at the leadership, they've allowed the word man and woman to be torn down into question. I mean, I don't want to say throw the baby out with the bathwater, but I just said that. So what do you advise people to do when it comes to our leadership? We have an election coming up here, and unfortunately, most people say I only have two choices. Well, RFK, you know, he's been kind of raising up a little bit. More people are looking at him, you know, but is he even going to be Perot at, you know, 8, 7, 10%, depending on where you're at? So from a leadership standpoint, what do you tell people? Because there are a lot of people like me that I can't have any more of the same group in there anymore, because they're only out for themselves, it seems like. So I feel jaded, and I feel like when I try to bring that up, examples of my experience, people label me, they discount me, they call me crazy. But like I said, when you can't even agree on what a man or a woman is at a, as a society, we got some real problems. So,
yeah,
your thoughts.
Yeah, and I've just over the last few years gotten to know a few different organizations very well. Obviously, I worked for 5 years at the Texas Public Policy Foundation, leading their Life Powered initiative. We're working on, you know, improving the education curriculum down to the classroom level. So kids, I think we are going to cure eco-anxiety because we're putting unbiased information about all forms of energy that's produced in this country, how responsibly well it's produced. Kids have to do cost-benefit analysis now when doing projects and choosing different types of energy. They've got to learn about energy poverty and what that means. And I think that's a great thing that's going to happen. That's the long game. And then, you know, now with my new organization, building this new trade organization, the American Energy Institute, I'd encourage people to go to our website, AmericanEnergyInstitute.com, and just sign up for updates. You may get 1 to 2 emails a week, but then as we start to see some things moving and we want you to do some action, we may reach out more often. But right now it's very infrequent because we don't want to overwhelm your inbox. And then so the Texas Public Policy Foundation, Heritage Foundation, I think is the nationwide leading group, the largest think tank in the country that supports free market principles and conservative values. I would really encourage people to look at any one of those groups, Texas Public Policy Foundation, Heritage Foundation, or the American Energy Institute that I now have the opportunity and blessed to lead. Because as I told a congressional roundtable last month, I said, you know, I'm sitting around a table with a bunch of other trade organizations, with a bunch of energy producers. And fortunately, I got to speak last and kind of close the meeting. But I told them, I said, we're the only ones here that are actually going to advocate for policies that would reduce the cost of energy. And I think that's really important. And I'm blessed to have incredible board members that are in the oil and gas industry, that are in the production of energy business, that support those policies because they understand the benefit to mankind. And when you have all these subsidies and mandates and market distortion, it just separates people from our money and our private property. And that's not a good way to advance the human condition and human flourishing.
No, Jason, one more point before we let you go. And I've been in the media for 40 plus years. Jason's been in as well. And one of the things that I always try to pick up on is the irony in a situation. And do you find it ironic that, and this might be a little bit of the smart ass in me, but do you find it ironic that the green agenda is positioning itself to be the ones that actually destroy the planet by lowering the carbon numbers to where plants can't grow and destroying lives and people's growth and development and the economic foundation by which people live, thrive, and prosper? Do you find the irony in that as I do?
I really do. And you know, there's great people out there like Patrick Moore. He's someone that co-founded Greenpeace, you know, this noble cause to save the whales, if you will, back in the 70s.
Yeah. But
they don't even care about the whales anymore. I mean,
no.
Greenpeace is not fighting the destruction of the whales that we see throughout. Oh, there goes my screensaver that we see happening along the northeastern United States with the implementation of this coastal wind, this inefficient wind source. So I really don't recommend people watch Michael Moore films very often, but I think the audience probably listening to and watching this are smart enough to pick out his Malthusian anti-human pieces of the movie called Planet of the Humans, where he talks about they were protesting, and this was something that was put on YouTube and almost immediately canceled. They censored Michael Moore, this incredible leftist, this communist, if you will. He got censored on YouTube because he put a movie out about the destruction from the environmental climate alarmist and their agenda. And he said, we used to have to protest mountaintop removal for coal. Now we're having to protest mountaintops from being removed for wind and for solar. This undense energy takes up thousands of acres by comparison. Yeah. You know, in Texas, you had 3,300 acres, over 99% destroyed solar panels because of a hailstorm that provides electricity for 30,000 homes when the sun is shining. And by comparison, nuclear power plant that would provide power for 2 million homes consistently takes up 84 acres. I mean, natural gas is very similar density. It doesn't take up a whole lot of land. You take up a few acres, you provide power to millions of people, but no, we're pushing this China political climate agenda, which is just propping up the Chinese. I mean, that you don't make wind and solar without Chinese components. You don't make EVs without Chinese components. They're winning. They're laughing all the way to the bank. And I hope people wake up. But for me to tell people to watch a leftist movie like Michael Moore and see the destruction that's happening as we speak, solar farms being approved in California and destroying historic Joshua trees.
You know, the irony is amazing. And, you know, going right back to you, Jason, you know, because Jason and I talk about this all the time. But Jason, you're right. It's about blurring the lines.
Yeah. Yeah. They're really destroying the earth to so-called save the planet.
What are those websites people can go to again? You had three of them, right? You had the
You can look up the Heritage Foundation. I think it's heritage.com, maybe heritage.org, texaspolicy.com, and americanenergyinstitute.com.
All right. Well, thanks for the time. I'm going to go ahead and stop here. Oh, well, never mind. I hit stop video instead of stop record because